So that's Enoch Mills' new hotel.
Well, it will be when they get it built, Chester.
Never heard of a cattle rancher going into hotel business before, Mr. Dillon.
Enoch Mills is a man of enterprise.
Look yonder at him. Why, he's as proud as a new father, ain't he?
Well, it isn't every day a man builds a new hotel in Taj, I always say.
No. Hello, Marshal.
Chester.
Oh, Mr. Mills.
Yeah, it's going up pretty fast, isn't it?
Oh, we've got most a month before it's finished, Marshal.
Yeah. How many rooms are you going to have?
15. Could have more, but this is going to be a class hotel, not some hay tent like Jim Dobie's Dodge House.
I'll bet he's jealous. Yeah.
Dobie's had monopoly in this town long enough. You're right about him being jealous, Chester. He's already done everything he can to keep me from building.
Oh? Oh, what's he done?
Well, he tried to buy up all the good lumber in town, for one thing. Good lumber in town. Thought he'd leave me with nothing but a lot of warpy cottonwood. But I got on to him soon enough, and I'm building with the best, Marshal. All ash and hackberry.
Here, hello, John. Hello,
Marshal. He's a scouting enemy, I guess.
Leave him scout. He'll be out of business soon
enough.
Scouting
the enemy.
Scouting the enemy, yeah.
Yeah, looks like a town meeting we're about to have. How are you, Marshal?
Chester.
Hello, Mr. Dobie.
Coming along fine, Dobie. Of course, it's only a little bitty hotel. Half the rooms, but twice the class of the Dodge House.
You won't get my trade.
Ah, John.
I've been in business too long.
Oh, Marshal.
That's what I figure. Who's your little friend, Dobie?
You'll never beat me, Eunuch.
How
you're
right,
getting
John?
Too old.
Old?
Fine, Marshal.
I'll eat the goose that fattens in your grave, Jim Dobie.
Yeah, not likely. Anyways, what do you know about the hotel business, Enoch? You won't last a month.
Good question. Now, look, you men. Dodge can use two hotels. There's plenty of trade here. Why don't you quit fighting each other?
You're too scared of a little competition, Dobie. You ain't slept a night since I started building.
You got a ranch to run, Enoch. That's enough for one man. You shouldn't be pushing on other people's territory.
Well, you ain't gonna stop me.
I've tried to stop you, and I'll go on trying.
All right, he's threatening me, Marshal. You heard him.
I'm going to fight you, Enoch. I'm going to fight you all the way. So now, you'd better start staying up nights.
Man belongs in jail, Marshal.
Dobie's a hard one, Enoch. He'll give you a fight, but I don't think he'll do anything illegal.
He won't, huh? Well, you wait and see. And it's going to be your fault for not stopping him now. The whole blame's going to be on your shoulders, Marshal, and I ain't going to let nobody forget it.
Kitty, get that thing out of here.
Well, this is the loneliest jailhouse I was ever in, Matt. Yeah. You and Chester don't spend much time here, do you?
Yeah, we'll be around more often if you drive in occasionally.
I haven't got a license.
Oh, I see. Well, you never did have.
Well, that's one reason I'm going to live so long. I came by to tell you something, Matt.
Oh?
Yeah. Look out for this Christmas traffic.
Don't tell me that's around again.
Yep. I met a guy at the Long Branch this afternoon. He didn't say much, but man like that stands out like a white buffalo.
Oh, you can pick him, Kitty. Gil Shank's a gunman and a crook. He isn't wanted that I know of, but he sure ought to be.
Well, I didn't figure him for a drummer.
Oh. Well, I think I'll let him stay around a few days. See what he's up to. A drummer?
Well, there are a couple of men with him, but it's hard to say if they're friends or if they just met.
Oh, well, they're probably friends. Gil Shank never liked traveling alone much.
Well, they didn't look like gunmen, Matt. They're just a couple of saddle bumps.
Maybe I'm wrong, then. Well, thanks for telling me, though, Kitty.
How's Enoch Mills' hotel coming? I haven't been by there lately.
Oh, they got the frame up. Enoch says it'll be another month anyway.
Huh? Jim Dobie been letting him alone?
Well, he keeps prodding him pretty hard.
Well, I guess those two will never get together.
Not the way they're going.
Gun my knee again.
Hello,
Miss Kitty.
Was it something scary you, Chester?
Oh, worse than that. Oh, that new hotel's on fire.
On fire?
And old Enoch saying Jim Dobie. Oh, my knee's killing me. You better get down there, Mr. Dillon.
Oh, dear.
Those were happy, happy halcyon times. And it's been close to 14 or 15 years since we did them. Some of those Saturday recording sessions seem as though they were just yesterday. And I wish they were tomorrow.
Within 2 years, Gunsmoke had become a smash hit. Favorable reviews from the critics came first. Then, in 1954, the program acquired its longtime sponsor, L&M Cigarettes. The series began to receive numerous awards. It was aired twice a week. There was a surprising amount of fan mail to answer. The program inspired several Western spinoffs, and there was even talk of transferring Gunsmoke to television. George Walsh begins the story.
The sponsor I remembered best, probably because I had more to do with it over a long period of time, was Liggett and Myers Tobacco Company. In those days, it was permissible to advertise cigarettes on the air. And I did the L&M commercials, and George Fenneman did the Chesterfield commercials. This brings to mind the day that we were in the middle of a rehearsal. One of the agency men representing Liggett and Myers Tobacco and L&M and or Chesterfield cigarettes was in the control room. And out on the prairie, all of a sudden, Marshall Dillon and Chester were riding along, and pow, a pistol shot came out of nowhere. And they hit the dirt and crawled down behind a clump of range grass. And Chester turned to the marshal and said, "Golly, Mr. Dillon, it's lucky he didn't have a rifle." "Cut," yelled the agency man. "We can't have that word lucky in there." And everything came to a halt until there was a great deal of editorial judgment. Finally, it did turn out into the script as lucky, but because Norm MacDonald, I remember him standing there drawing himself up to his full Scottish 6'2" at the time and saying to this man, "Do you mean to tell me that I am to have Chester Proudfoot say to Marshall Dillon, 'It is extremely fortunate that he didn't have a rifle'?" So lucky stayed in the script. But this was the type of thing that I never have understood, the advertising agency business. I've been exposed to it, and I use the word advisedly. I've been close to it from my standpoint, my side of the business. But I've never understood the aura of fear and wonderment that surrounds this business. I remember once that the small agency that Cunningham and Walsh had on the West Coast. Now, my real legitimate name is Walsh, and I am no relation whatever to the Walsh of Cunningham and Walsh, a very big, successful advertising agency. But one time during the course of commercials that we were recording, aside from the program, we were wild-tracking the commercials, one of the representatives of the West Coast agency was having a difficult time. It just seemed that I couldn't do anything to please him. No matter how I did this L&M commercial, it just wasn't right. He didn't like anything about it. He didn't like the speed. He didn't like the pacing. He didn't like my accents. He didn't like anything about it. And after the tension began to build and I had done many attempts at it, I had a moment of, I thought, was jest. I leaned back to the microphone and said, "Well, if that's the way you want it, okay, but I'm not sure that Uncle Fred would like it that way." Now, I had learned shortly before that Fred Walsh was a real character who in those days was an old man, but still used to terrify everybody at the headquarters back in New York. So I just threw this in facetiously. But the man in the control room didn't take it that way. He thought, "Good Lord, this guy might really be related to the old man." From that day on, I could do nothing wrong for that man. And as long as I knew him, there was always this aura of doubt, mixed with fear, that he might be related to the old man in New York. I wasn't, but I cherish this memory because I'm bad when it comes to a put-on. But this was one time I think I got away with it.
Over the 10 years that Gunsmoke was on the air, we were fortunate to win a number of awards. For instance, the Radio Television Mirror Daily Awards. We won one for Best Radio Drama or Best Radio Western in 54 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and I believe in 9, but I'm not sure about that. One of the things, and I always hesitate to say this, but I think it should be known, that perhaps the most deserving award, which was never passed out, was the one that should have gone to John Meston, who wrote hundreds of these scripts, and to the best of my knowledge, received no specific award for it, which I think is rather a tragedy and an oversight. There were times that John came in for his good notices. For instance, in a Jack Gould column in the Times, late 52 or early 53, Jack Gould gave us really quite a rave review, and I think was largely responsible for the show continuing on and indeed picking up commercial sponsorship. The Gunsmoke name appears in a lot of odd places. As a matter of fact, it's in the Congressional Record. A rather amusing thing when someone was saying that Matt Dillon would never have done that, and then he was reminded that Matt Dillon never really existed, and he said no, but he was so real it seemed as though he really existed.
At this time, it is with great pride that Gunsmoke is able to bring you a specially recorded message by the Honorable Edward F. Arne, Governor of the State of Kansas. Ladies and gentlemen, Governor Arne.
It's a real pleasure for me on behalf of Kansans everywhere to congratulate the CBS Radio Network, the writers, producers, directors, actors, and technicians on the splendid job you are doing with Gunsmoke. Here is real adult Western drama, without the usual horse opera cliches portraying an era and community of Kansas that graphically marked the formative years of our great state. Let me point out, however, the Dodge City of today is a far cry from the Dodge City so vividly brought to life in Gunsmoke. From those early pioneer and frontier days, Dodge City has developed into one of the fine cities of our state, industrially, agriculturally, and historically. The folks of Dodge City, and indeed all the people of this great sunflower state, thank you for a good job well done.
Thank you, Governor Arne.
It was released twice a week. It would be released first on a Sunday night and then re-released the following Saturday morning. We had a tremendous audience. As I recall, I think we were something like, because of the double show, we had an audience of something like 50 million people every week, which was fantastic, you know.
Gunsmoke got its share of fan mail, no more nor less than other shows that were on the air at that time. We tried to answer our fan mail. We had special letterheads printed up in period style saying, Office of the Marshal, 1871, Dodge City, Kansas. And at the bottom it said, For Marshal Dillon, by, and then I would sign my name, and everybody was satisfied. We tried to answer it all, and I think that's good public relations.
Chester got fan mail that generally showed some irritation at wanting to know why he had behaved like that, or why hadn't he used a little sense, you know. People were always wanting to do Chester over, which was kind of remarkable. The letters that came were advising me to shape up or ship out. Bill got a lot of letters for his the magnificence of his portrayal. I never got any unfriendly letters, but you got the feeling some of these people would shake me good if they got a chance.
There was one letter that I can still remember, addressed to John Mesta, and came from Texas, from a fan named Effie. And she had some particular ideas about what should be done next. And well, let John tell you this.
Well, this is a letter, a fan letter I got, the only one I ever got, from Rogers, Texas, September 1953. It was addressed to me, and inside there's no date or anything. It's from a woman called Effie, and I won't use her last name, it's an ordinary name. The letter reads very simply, Oh John, you have to come home, stick your toes to this fire. I have just been wondering about you in this cold. Ma, am I hungry? I want supper. Been down in the timber rolling them logs. How about the kids? Done fed them, baked their toes, put them to bed. Have to milk them cows. Seen them hens laid. Feed that old mule. Well, I guess that all. Oh, my back. What's wrong with you, John? Thinking about that hard day tomorrow, honey? Honey. You got to work to make them kids something to eat. Oh, my back. Got to see a doctor. Get some pills. Oh, John, you just got nerves. You will be all right. Them children can't eat rabbits to live. Signed, Effie. My favorite fan, whoever she is. Great. Lovely lady.
5 or 6 years after we had been on the air, I have parked my car, and I'm walking across the parking lot to go into CBS to do another set of two. And a guy walks up to me, and he says, "Mr. Conrad?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Boy, I just think that you're fantastic. It's a great show, Gunsmoke, and the way you play Matt Dillon is just absolutely super, and I think you're great. Would you do me a great favor?" And I said, "Well, sure, if I can, certainly." He said, "Would you do the opening for me?" And I looked at him, and I said, the what?" He said, "The opening." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I really don't know what you mean." And he said, the opening to Gunsmoke, the thing you say every Saturday or Sunday night when you open the show. I said, "Gee, are you not thinking of another show, maybe? Because I really don't remember." And he said, "Oh, okay, fine. You're a big star, huh? Well, fine. Thank you very much for being so courteous to me." And he turns furious and walks away from me. And I still didn't know what it was. And I walked into the rehearsal, and I said, "Hey, the funniest thing happened to me," and I related the story. And they said, "Oh, God, it's the opening." That I said, "What opening?" They said, "You recorded it 7 years ago, and you haven't done it since."
When Gunsmoke went on the air in April of 52, it was really the only one of its kind. In the years that followed, I think there were a good many imitators, some very successful and some just poor imitations. Shows not only went from radio to television, but a couple of shows came from television to radio. For example, Have Gun Will Travel, which was on adjacent to the television program of Gunsmoke, became a radio program after the fact, several years later, and was quite successful. John Daner played the lead. He played Paladin, the part that Dick Boone originated.
We never really went into depth about Paladin, except that he sort of came out of nowhere. He was the Robin Hood. He was the man who could do no wrong. He righted all evils and protected the poor from the depredations of the wealthy and so forth. He was a rather one-dimensional character, if you want my honest opinion about Paladin. And even on the television show, it was it had that aspect to it, unlike Gunsmoke, where the characters seemed to be more real. There was fantasy in Paladin, you see. But that didn't take away from the fact that it was a lot of fun to do.
Then there were other shows that were in this general area of Western or period. One of them that I was connected with was Fort Laramie, starring Raymond Burr. It was a cavalry show, again, 1870 or 1875, in Wyoming, and a successful one. John Daner starred in another radio show called Frontier Gentleman.
That was the brainchild of Tony Ellis. He was a writer. He wrote a lot of escapes and romances, and he just got the idea that there should be a civilized individual showing up in the West and the adventures that befall him, thinking mainly of the English remittance man who was sent over to this country by his family in England because they don't quite know what to do with him, but he's better off out of sight. Sure, they'll send him his monthly stipend to keep him going, but as long as he doesn't bother them, that's what they're after. So he shows up in the United States and goes west. And this was, by the way, quite common in the West in those days, you know. The remittance man idea was quite worldwide, where the English would send their men off to the colonies, their unwanted scions. But the English man was a great force in the development of the West. And Frontier Gentleman was based more or less upon that idea.
The radio show had been on the air about a year when it became apparent it was a fairly solid operation. It also was apparent in those days that television was looming large. So Meston and I talked to the radio executives about, was there a way to move it to television? And indeed, they'd already been thinking about this, and it was a it was in the works, so Meston and I were convinced that we'd be producing and writing the television series, which, as it turned out, we were not, which was probably a very good thing. They hired a novelist and a motion picture producer-director named Charles Marquis Warren to come in and get the television series organized, and I was allowed to come in as an associate producer, which I must admit I was very pleased to do. Then came the matter of course, the cast, once it had been determined to go ahead with the television version. And it seemed obvious to me that it should be Bill Conrad, Howard McNair, Parley Bear, and Georgia Ellis, because they'd created the parts, and they were indeed Matt and Doc and Kitty and Chester. But I didn't know enough to know that it didn't always work that smoothly. The determination was made to test several people for the several parts, and it looked for a while as though the Gunsmoke radio cast wasn't even going to be considered or tested. There was a Los Angeles newspaper man named Hal Humphreys who was a great fan of the radio show and a great fan of the people and the actors, and he petitioned and lobbied in his Los Angeles Times column day after day, and I think was largely responsible in securing for the radio cast an audition. We taped in Studio 43, I think it was, at TV City. It was all right. It wasn't staggering. It was all right, but I don't think anybody upstairs even saw it, because it was purely a token audition so that the radio people would keep on working in radio, and which they did for another 7 years. It was determined to go with Jim Arness, who was a protege of Duke Wayne's and a good actor, although a newcomer, and Dennis Weaver and Amanda Blake and Milburn Stone, all good, solid actors. Bill Warren really should get a tremendous amount of credit for transcribing or transferring the shows from radio to television. I think he was able to keep in his production and direction of the first script, which was a Meston television script, in being able to keep the feel and the intent of what the radio show had been. It was Bill who wardrobed the principals, and for many years they were the only well-wardrobed Westerns on the air. Bill was responsible for the kind of photography and the kind of sets. I was able to be of considerable help, I hope, by being able to describe how we had pictured the sets and how we had pictured the Long Branch and the street and where the jail cells were and all the other things that we'd worked with in radio.
When the transition was made to television, the first any of us in radio knew about it was when we read it in the trade papers. We were a little disgruntled that we hadn't been considered right for the parts. It's a little nonplussing to be told that you're not right for something that you have created, but that happens all the time.
The character transfer to television was generally faithful, except in the case of Chester, played on radio by Parley Bear. CBS officials started by changing Chester's last name from Proudfoot to Good.
And when they made the transition, I was told that one of the officials with CBS said we'd better change his name because Parley might have a cause for plagiarism suit. And I saw this man in the lobby of the station one day, and I said, I trust CBS, even though CBS doesn't apparently trust me. And I said, and I have less cause to trust CBS than CBS has to trust me. And that is, I got the story that they changed his name because they were afraid I would kick up a fuss. What I should really have kicked up a fuss about, and as well as Bill and Howard and everybody else, is for the first 156 shows, they used radio scripts for the television thing almost in toto. And it was a little irritating to hear lines that you had written, to hear your own ad libs incorporated into the television series. But why joust with windmills, you know? We didn't get it, and those fellows did a good job. I think Jim Arness as Dylan became sort of a pillar on the national scene, and I'm not taking away from him anything that he did in his performance or in painting the character because he had 20 years of great success. But my opinion is this. I do think Bill would have been better.
Dennis Weaver's television portrayal of Chester was different, too.
Dennis played him as a younger man, and I always considered Chester sort of ageless. If somebody had said to me, how old is Chester, as you play him, I'd honestly say, I don't know. He could have been anywhere from 30 to 50. Chester was certainly no romancer. He was embarrassed by ladies, and though he had his moments, they never quite came to fruition. Even with Kitty, to Chester, it was always Miss Kitty. He was unusual for those times. It was quick to rise when a lady came in, and he had little or no contact with women in those days. They didn't marry the likes of Chester because he was sort of on the outside looking in, and of course there was always a scarcity of women in Dodge City and those cow towns along the trail, and the marriageable ones were already married, or the ones who had a future for marriage were very zealously guarded, and they were always looking for someone with more money to come along than Chester had. But we played him differently. Someone said, did Chester limp on radio? And I said, no. Now, how true this story is, I don't know. I've heard it repeated many times that Chester was given a limp on his character for TV because he was coming on pretty strong as a romantic figure, and they felt that if Dennis played him, Dennis is a very handsome man, they felt he was overshadowing the character of Dylan. And so they gave him some physical handicap. I don't think it was necessary, but again, who am I to fight with success? Dennis was very successful as Chester for a great many years.
The television show was bought quickly from the pilot film that Bill Warren made and went on the air in September of 55 and was almost immediately well received. Part of this, of course, was that there had been 3 years of pre-publicity because the Gunsmoke radio show had been enormously well received in those 3 years prior, so it was a happy wedding. Bill produced and directed the first 26 shows, and I think a combination of fatigue and pressure and just the weight of carrying that big a job all by himself made it difficult to continue, and he left after 26 weeks to do a feature. When Bill left, I was able and lucky enough to slip into the mantle of producer of the series, not attempting to direct any. So I stayed with the show as producer from the 27th show through the next 9 years, and left the series in 1964.
We'll return to the biography of Gunsmoke in just one moment.